Hello and welcome to the Agents of Hope podcast. My name is Tim Cox and I'm the usual host of the Agents of Hope podcast. But today is a special introductory episode where I'll be talking to Dr. Alexandra Sewell about a book that she's got in the works and a fantastic Agents of Hope mini-series about diverse voices in educational practice. About some of the ideas that underpin her thoughts and ideas in this book and talking about the different people that she's worked with in order to pull this together. But before I do my kind of précis of everything that Ali has done, I'd like to invite Ali to introduce herself and talk about how we came to be having this conversation and why she's so passionate about bringing diverse voices to light in education.
Yeah, so how we came about being here is I discovered your podcast via Twitter and have been a long time listener. And as I said to you previously, I think you've just been doing a really cool thing with it. So the book itself, the project and how it came about, it's my second book. So my first book was co-authored with a colleague of mine called Joe Smith, and we wrote an undergraduate introductory textbook to special educational needs, disability and inclusion. And off the back of the first book, which I really enjoyed writing, I wanted to dive in as soon as possible into a second book. The idea for the second book for diverse voices in educational practice was floating around for a really long time in the back of my head. I've done research and published papers on this general idea of listening to others and voice and co-participation. And then I found in my practice, it was an area of my practice I was always trying to improve. And then COVID-19 hit and we all were in lockdown. And I just felt the world was going into a period where more than ever, being able to listen to people and respond to them meaningfully, not just in a tokenistic way, was more important than ever. I loved the idea of a workbook that combined theory with practice and made that bridge.
I mean, it's really interesting to listen to, I guess, the context and the burgeoning, I guess, not necessarily burgeoning importance generally of, you know, listening to voices within kind of educational fields. But, you know, COVID-19 and the chaos that's ensued and many of the other, I guess, social justice issues that have become extremely prevalent during that time have really, you know, amplified the need for deep listening.
I think so.
And also done because everybody's been sitting, you know, for a long period of time inside, not being able to take action on things.
Yeah.
Has probably a polarization was going on before that. But in terms of listening to each other, there has been a sense that there was this kind of step back and thought, oh, we need to be doing things a bit differently. And then there was a pushback on that of, you know, this is coming from a particular political field. And,
you know,
that has then, the people have gone into two camps or three or how many other camps about that. And there has been polarization and, the more that I think I've worked as an educational psychologist and always, you know, during my time in education, which is, you know, over a decade now, is that, you know, deep listening has to be part of it. And there's often this focus on action and listening is a kind of softer, more kind of frilly skill, I guess, kind of seen as something that, oh, you know, well,
one of the terms for them is literally soft skills.
Yeah.
I always disagree with. It's nothing soft about it. If anything, it's the hardest skill to achieve.
I think so. And that kind of profound nature of it. And having kind of read for you a couple of chapters of the book when they were in, you know, they may not be the final chapters, but having looked at what you've sent me, I really like that. You know, kind of the workbook style of it. And that sense of taking this theory and placing it into practice within a couple of pages rather than trying to ingest it and then apply it somewhere else. I really like that, particularly in the parents and carers chapter, like that. So that's really good. So if I could think about kind of, so we started that kind of this idea of where, you know, you start to think about this book and build momentum. On your first book. So what is your background before that? You know, did you train as educational psychologists? I know that you're kind of working in academics now. So what's
I trained at the University of Birmingham and graduated in 2016. Before that, my journey was very typical, stereotypical almost, I would say. I did my undergraduate in psychology at Swansea University, and then I stayed on to do a master's degree. And then I spent a year being a support worker, play worker with children with learning difficulties. And then I was lucky enough to get a position as an assistant education psychologist. And then went on to train. That's another reason I sort of wanted to write the book as well. And I say write, but really I'm the editor of the book, as we'll come to discuss. There's so many contributors to the book. I'm very much an in an editorial position rather than the person who wrote the whole book. This idea that for me, getting into educational psychology, I'm hyper aware now. I wasn't in the past. I just didn't have the understanding. Hyper aware now that I'm in that privileged position where getting onto the course and getting into the profession was very much helped by who I am and personal resources I have. Yeah. So now with my work, it's about trying to put the ladder down rather than pull it up. I'm aware that where I am is very much contributed to by the privilege and the luck I've had. And then after training, I worked at Wolverhampton for almost 2 years. I was a main grade EP in a local authority. Yeah, and then I'd always wanted to give academia a go, because actually when I was doing the doctorate, I really enjoyed the writing and research side of things and never looked back, really. I really enjoy the teaching.
Yeah. It's always amazing when I talk to, you know, the variety of guests that I've had on the podcast about their backgrounds, and there are similarities. And I guess if you've got to go through a kind of social graces similarities, there have been lots of similarities between the guests. And there does seem to be a push now more than ever.
Yeah.
You know, the target recording, which is in late September, about that diversifying case of psychology candidates, really.
Definitely.
And thinking about supporting that journey. And I think as a profession that we can be like hyper aware of our context sometimes, and whereas, you know, and moving away from perhaps just thinking, oh, this is a purely meritocratic approach to recruiting psychologists for the future, which then potentially have a highly influential impact on special educational needs and education in a broader way. And I think another commonality really with that is that kind of sense of, although we are relatively homogenous kind of profession at the moment, kind of white middle class, largely female, I guess, but there is a sense of vocation of what to do with that privilege and how to manage it, perhaps a frustration with systems that don't quite.
Yes, and I'm not, and I don't want any listeners to think that I'm saying, you know, in producing this book, I'm changing the world, and that's my MO, and that's what I'm thinking, because to be in that position of privilege and to reflect, I think it's important not to also not want to fall into the trap of white savior or middle class savior. I don't think I'm that. It's just kind of saying, just trying to caveat what I previously said with this perspective of it's just small things in a small way that I'm doing. just aware of the position I'm in. But that's the lovely thing about being an ed psych and being an educator is every day you get to be in service to others.
I do think what you're doing is quite profound, and you know, but at the individual and that rippling out to a more systemic level, because it's really important how we do things, and who we do them for, and what's driving that, and I guess in terms of this podcast, like how that develops hope for the system in general and for education. You know, for me, education should be a community or a society's, you know, hope for the future, and putting their resources into how they do that to develop something that hasn't been before. And that's really exciting. And I guess what's underpinning a lot of what we're talking about at the moment, I guess, is that idea about participation and widening that.
Yeah.
Beyond kind of policymakers and I guess big number outcome sort of things, to a sense of meaning and coherence in an individual or a family or a community or a school's life.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And in academia, there's so much emphasis on impact at the macro level. Does your research impact policy and legislation, which of course is very incredibly valid and does have wide-reaching implications. But yeah, I do consider myself in this small corner of practitioner research and practitioner and student books at the micro level. But I do agree with you that there's also a lot of power to be had at the micro level and how we influence each other and work with each other, which is exactly what the book is about. And I'm so glad you said you enjoyed the workbook style of it and the activities, because as editor, I really had at the forefront of my mind that this book shouldn't be telling or even directing. It's a learning resource, and hopefully teachers are going to read it and psychologists are going to read it and other, you know, teaching assistants, etc. And they're actually going to take away their own understanding of the theory and reinterpretation of the theory and therefore their own actions. There's no one activity that says, do this. Every activity is, okay, now we've given you this example and this theory. If you were to use it, how would you? I didn't want anything to be like a directive.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the sense that I got from reading some of the chapters was that it was enabling and enlightening rather than ivory tower.
Oh, yeah.
This is the hit and absolutely right thing that you should do. And if you don't do it, then you're a different type of practitioner who this book is for. And I guess, you know, that is one of the big reasons that I got, you know, I come from a non-psychological background, studying history and then kind of fell into working in a school. And it was what psychology gave me, or maybe not gave me, but enabled and enlightened me to do, was to give me frameworks in order to manage the chaos of working with hormonal teenagers and manage myself as somebody in their early 20s to understand what to do, how I could do it, and what outcomes are important. Because I remember, you know, the first 6-7 years of working in school dominated in terms of the, you know, the rhetoric within the school systems I was working by Ofsted and results, and I was placed pastorally, which isn't, you know, they are assessed by both of those things.
Sure.
But the day-to-day was in relational understanding of some of people's psychologies and why people like behave or engage or learn in different ways and how that was okay. And I guess that was the sense of when I was, you know, I went straight to the chapter on parental engagement. That's one of my big interests. I'm like, what's this going to tell me? I've looked at it, thought that would have been really helpful. But I was terrified of calling parents. And, you know, I had the sense of, I guess, an espoused value that I was going to be a good inclusive practitioner, but didn't really have the ways of enacting that I guess
here that chapter is written by my colleague Angela Hodgkins at the University of Worcester, and I love that chapter too. I think she's a great writer, and I'll feed that back to her, Tim, because she'd love to hear that. Her research at the moment is about empathy in the early years and working with parents.
We've talked about what kind of participation could be, but perhaps for our listeners who perhaps aren't as baked in these ideas, how could people think about participation in a way that helps them to make sense about what's helpful, what's enabling, what's enlightening, all of those sort of things?
We think, okay, participation, but actually when you break that down, what is actually meaningful can be critiqued, which is where the book started essentially for me to unpick that idea, which I do in the first chapter. So I chose the term meaningful voice practice because when I thought about what I wanted to have as a thread running through each chapter and all the contributions be, it always came back to this same idea of action and change, in that you can listen and you can respond, but it's not meaningful if there isn't some kind of tangible outcome to that. The main theory used in the first chapter is Sherry Arnstein, The Ladder of Participation, which is super old now, was published in 1969, but I still just think it's absolutely seminal as a piece of work. And if you think about the era it was published in, towards the end of the 60s, and it was published in America, it is a result of the first kind of citizen rights movement.
Yeah.
So I think it still has so much application today. Yeah, and kind of what that theory talks about is that, you know, it's called a ladder, this idea that there are levels, abstracted levels of meaningfully listening to others. And as you move up the levels, your listening and interacting with them becomes more meaningful because it has two outcomes. One, it leads to more action, so more tangible change as a result of engaging with other people, but also a transference of power. Rather than a reduction in power or like an equalizing of power, what for me, I think is fascinating about Arnstein and the Ladder of Participation, and what I think sometimes gets misinterpreted or missed out, is the idea is they weren't advocating for, you know, reducing power imbalances. They were actually advocating for creating a new power imbalance in favor of what Arnstein writes about in the original paper, the have-nots. So they talk about the haves and have-nots and the haves. And that's quite a useful phrase, I think, because it's quite general and generalizable, because the haves are essentially anyone who's traditionally found themselves in a position of power, and the have-nots are those who have, you know, power being your voice matters and your opinions and your perceptions are active, not just actively listened to, but people seek them out and therefore make changes in response to them. Essentially, as you move up the ladder, you move towards partnership and delegated power and citizen power. And all of these are level of sort of meaningfulness in terms of listening to others is being acted on. Tokenism occurs when people are just informed. So you could say you've engaged in some voice practice if you tell people kind of what you're doing, right? That's still sort of some kind of interaction. There's a level known as consultation where you actually canvass people's opinions, but that's it. You don't necessarily do anything with them. Or if you do, it might be something quite small and not significant. There's placation, which is where you do actually do something as a result of listening to the opinions of people who are so-called have not, but again, it's not meaningful because it's something that's done just to keep people in their place, essentially, to put it colloquially. So I always kind of come back to the ladder of participation, and that really was the main theory that made me think of this idea of meaningful voice practice. But then my supervisor at Birmingham, the great Sue Morris, had always spoken to me about espoused values versus enacted values, and the idea of word, deed, alignment, and the psychological concept of behavioral integrity. That too, I've used as a theory, kind of have this backbone to the book and this thread of meaningful voice practice throughout the chapters. behavioral integrity is essentially the idea that you don't just say what your values are, but you behave in line with them as well. The espoused values are really prevalent in a lot of school contexts. And on the website, they're in policy documents. Yeah. And then inclusion is often an espoused value. Then parents and children, you know, teachers find themselves receiving behavior from others that's not aligning with that value. So I think integrity is key as well. But then I guess the other kind of critique of that and the other issue here is the word voice. And that's received critique from some camps in academia and practice, especially the phrase giving voice.
Mm.
You know, it's this idea of who are you to give voice? Nobody feels like they need to be given voice. They already have a voice. And we have contributors talking about co-production, which is very anti the word voice. So as I've kind of said before, in the book, there's no one way of thinking about this topic and doing this topic. So I use the word voice, but I appreciate it's not an appropriate term that everyone likes. So there are other terms in the book as well, such as co-production, which very much puts itself at, far up the ladder of participation.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when you're talking now, I'm just kind of thinking about what are the underpinnings of what comes from giving voice or co-production. Yeah. And I think if that's about developing agency and ensuring fairness, and I think those are two kind of composites of co-production as well, having talked to Naomi Boswell and people who are kind of big advocates of that approach. That's good, right? That is something that we perhaps should aim for. And I guess, listening to voice and helping people to enact on it, allows us to think about who and what is education for. And why are we doing this? Because I guess if we are super sure about what education is for from, and we assume that everybody else thinks that, or we think it's for the common good, and we are delivering something, I guess, in a sort of banking way of we've got this great product and you're going to consume it, whether it applies to your life or not, because it will be good for you. Then you're going to stay at those kind of lower levels of voice. It won't lead to citizenship because you're trying to develop a certain type.
Yeah.
A type of pupil or type of adult. And I guess that's a large part of what we can do, is to really, help schools and education systems to reflect on that and to think about this is what this one person or these group of people or this whole community are saying that they want from their education, and allows them to tailor it to that rather than being a product which could be marketed out to certain types of parents or certain tick boxy Ofsted things. So it's, for me, this seems really fundamental. And the other, psychological theory, and it's, psychodynamic theory, which isn't the most, which is controversial in itself, but that idea of contained, of feeling that you're understood and responded to appropriately, being able to actually express those things is core to having a coherent life, right?
Exactly. Being acknowledged by another.
Yeah. And through that, you can develop hope and trust. And those are really important things if you're going to live in socially. So I think the arguments about it are obviously important, but in terms of what it can bring as an approach, it seems so important, particularly given our current context, where we have, lots of social justice issues going on in the world, as well as an unstable political system.
Yeah.
Um, where we, you know, maybe we're coming to a time where we need to think about what things are for and why we're doing it in order to see our ways out a bit.
For me, writing the book proposal was an act of hope, trying to do one small thing during a time where the values I like to think I have and try to enact was getting harder, or seemed to be getting harder.
Why do these injustices happen? What is the theory saying about that?
Gosh, that is a huge question. There's so many theories around social injustice. The one I focus on in the book, and again, that threads through pretty much every chapter, is epistemic injustice. Now, mostly known as discriminatory epistemic injustice, because the literature's sort of developed. And that was kind of written and created by an academic known as Fricker. And the reason I chose that as one of the theories I wanted to focus on in terms of examining injustice is because it's at the epistemic level, which is epistemology and very philosophical, this theory of or study of truth, knowledge, how we create knowledge, how we share knowledge and collectively decide what is knowledge and what isn't. Because we're focusing on voice, and not just spoken voice. Obviously, by voice, we mean the many forms of communication that exist, but it's very much at the abstracted level of someone professing their personal epistemic view of the world, their personal knowledge base, their personal views on what is truthful or isn't. So kind of wanted to focus on that theory, because epistemic injustice is basically the idea that some of us are epistemically privileged. Our opinions, our so-called facts, are believed, and more so than that, are integrated into a collective knowledge base. And for other people, that doesn't happen. So they kind of experience an injustice. And there's two forms. There's testimonial injustice and there's hermeneutical injustice. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Testimonial injustice occurs when a listener doesn't believe and discredit what a speaker is communicating because of some pre-existing prejudice against them. A basic example, it could be that if there is a disabled person or a person who is disabled, I like to use both person first and non-person first language, just as a side caveat, because I know some people like it, some people don't. So I just say both, just if people wonder why I said both there. You know, might go to a doctor and share a change in their condition, and that a doctor may not believe them and think they're being over the top and discredit their truth, discredit what they're saying because of some pre-held prejudice. The prejudice might be disabled people who are disabled are hypochondriacs and overreact. That's one very specific small example of testimonial injustice. And then hermeneutical injustice is somewhat different in that some groups of people, some identity groups, don't have access to shared linguistic processes in order to understand and then also share their own knowledge. So understand collective knowledge. And an example that Fricker gives of that was in the 1940s, 1950s, the term sexual harassment hadn't been coined yet. And sexual harassment in the workplace hadn't been written into law. So women and some men, obviously, who experienced that didn't have the collective linguistic resources to communicate with others what they were experiencing. So therefore, it's a hermeneutical injustice. Yeah, so hopefully, I feel I've been speaking on this for a little while now, but hopefully I've explained that in a way that listeners will see why I took that route into thinking how and why this injustice occurs. It's because we always have this shared social understanding, but in terms of who gets the right to shape that and say what it should be, it's unequal. And I just think Fricker's work is exemplary in helping me understand that. So therefore, I put it into the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think those two ways put across are quite helpful, although they have sort of kind of academic terms behind them. It made me think of the doctoral research that I've talked about, the podcast before that I did about fathers' engagement with their children's development, and perhaps why EPs or educational professionals don't perhaps engage with fathers as often as they do with mothers. Yeah. And perhaps there may be some sense of that sort of testimonial, or maybe there is a gender bias because we don't believe fathers know about this sort of thing or are interested in it or they're any good at it. Yeah. But there did seem to be kind of this theme that underpins farmers' experiences, that they felt quite alienated outside of the family units, that their role was particularly relevant to the context of the family and the context of the family makeup, and they had a role within that, which might have been earning or might have been caring, but there was a sacrifice involved with that, which meant they sacrificed other opportunities, which might have been going to meetings about the child. And therefore, they hadn't developed the language, I guess, which is when we think about educational meetings, they're often full of jargon sort of stuff because there's so many services and signposting involved that I guess if you're not in that meeting, then you just don't know what somebody's talking about if they start talking about CAMS or, you know.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an example of hermeneutical injustice. Oh my goodness, academia, psychology, and local authorities love an acronym an initialization of words. And then they'll keep using that jargon, I guess, essentially. And right, parent, children, and actually other professionals as well could be experiencing a form of injustice because they don't have access to the meaning of those words. And even at the level of creating those terms, right, and deciding what they mean. And your research sounds fascinating, and I think is so crucial because that, again, I think it's a great example of potential testimonial injustice.
Yeah, and I think there's an element on my journey to coming to those conclusions, I guess, and formulating that research, is that I had to do a lot of digging within myself to think about, you know, by that point I worked in schools for 8 years and probably, you know, could have counted the amount of times that I'd included fathers on meetings as a matter of course.
Yeah.
About 5 or 6 times, maybe, or 5 or 6 families out of hundreds of families that I would have worked with. And I had to think, well, what are the assumptions behind that? And really, if I'm going to think about, you know, development of agency or development of hope around it, you have to have the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
And I guess me presuming that fathers were busy or were there for discipline reasons, whatever it was.
Exactly, yeah.
Because of my idea about gender roles, which is, I guess, insidious within particularly our Western context.
Yeah.
Then that meant that I wasn't developing the opportunity to become more inclusive, and I wasn't providing the opportunity for fathers to do something to contribute within those meetings, and also assuming that the mother would always want to be there and always want to make those decisions. So I mean, I think there's lots of things that can underpin either that testimonial injustice or the hermeneutical injustice, and none of them, I think, education professionals are well-meaning, but to come back to that theme of the practical theory-based activities that you place in your book help to provide an alternative ending.
This was the greatest challenge, I think, in terms of trying to translate theory into practice and workbook activities, because something philosophical is by its very nature abstracted from the real world. So I hope when people read it, we've achieved that throughout the chapters. I guess we'll have to wait for the book to come out and wait for feedback. But I didn't want to shy away from it because being a practitioner who's gone into academia, I do feel in a somewhat unique perspective to always want to relate any theory to practice and to lived experience. So, yeah.
And perhaps that is one of the privileges or benefits of being an educational psychologist in some ways, is the ability to explicitly talk about how theory might relate to the challenge that everybody's come to discuss. And that's why I love this profession, because it allows you to do that.
Yeah.
So in terms of ways that we can counteract or prevent these injustices, what can we do? I know in your book there'll be lots of examples of that, but are there any main themes or concepts that underpin it?
Yeah, one thing that really kind of stuck with me emerged from the Pupil Voice chapter and from our contributors, co-production, and another kind of tool or approach known as the GEM, the Grid Elaboration Method. This idea that the very, very critical first step is not just assuming that people want to get involved, if that makes sense, if people want to speak out. So I think that's the starting point for whoever you're working or interacting with. There's this notion of silence in the voice of the child. Some children just don't want to speak out, and that's absolutely okay. And, you know, our contributors, Naomi Boswell and Erica Douglas Osborne, gave a really great worked example of their project in terms of co-production and how, first of all, it was the question, well, do you even want to do a co-production project? Yes, that's step one. And then in terms of sort of from that, I just think it's an orientation. And this is what I kind of concluded at the end of the book. So the final chapter, I had intended to have someone write it. So it focused on LGBTQ plus educators and pupils. But the person I had wanted to write it was interested, but didn't have the time. So I was kind of stuck close-ish, not-ish to deadline, and didn't really have anyone to approach, because the big important thing for me was I approached people who I either knew, had a professional relationship, or I didn't, but I had genuinely followed their work for a while. So therefore, trying to be meaningful in my own production of the book, co-production of the book even. And so with that final chapter, we have many, many contributors. And, you know, I reflect at the end of it that it didn't go how I had originally planned in terms of being meaningful. But I kind of conclude that's okay, because it's an orientation. Sure, we talk about lots of theories and approach, but I do think, whether you call it meaning voice work or meaning voice practice or co-production, whatever you term it for yourself, and kind of develop your own concept of what we're talking about, it's a value first. And then the action follows on from that. And action will always be different in terms of your profession, who you are personally, what context you're in, the specific school or the local authority, academia, whatever it may be. The actions will always be different. And sometimes you'll feel like it hasn't gone how you initially intended. But as long as you're always orienting towards that value of others matter, and they're going to have different perceptions and lived experiences to me, and I want to, at the very least, give them the opportunity for me to listen and to actually want to do something about it, then that's how you go about it in a nutshell.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It makes me kind of, a couple of things you're saying there, kind of thinking about having, you know, value-based practice being really important. And I found that increasingly helpful as a reflective tool for myself individually as a practitioner, because you can really feel when something is aligning with your values or is not. So I think Rogers called it kind of incongruence, that kind of feeling of that internal break when you're not feeling that this is meaningful or this is helpful and
being authentic.
Yeah, that authenticity of the work that we do. And that's really important in education, to get a sense of that. But also that kind of, you know, another Rogers idea that, you know, it's, you know, he talks about the good life being a journey, not a destination. And I think that's, you know, good practice is a journey, not a destination. You know, we need to start off from a well-meaning point and a values-driven point, and theory can give us the roadmap, but it's our experiences of applying and revisiting theory and writing and talking about it and developing new ideas, which allow us to get towards somewhere better. And that seems really fundamental now, and it sounds like it's like a really important project. And I think with anything, you know, whether that be writing a book or hosting a podcast or just talking to colleagues or friends about ideas, it's almost always kind of, you might think, oh, this is the end of the road with this, but it's always a jumping off point to something else. And perhaps, although to you, it feels like this is something, you know, a small pebble being thrown into a big pond and there are some ripples, is that, you know, people will probably catch the waves of those ripples and it might inform that next cycle for something else.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
But anyway, I mean, I think it's really helpful what you've done. And so when is the book set to be published, or is it published?
Yeah. No, it comes out end of October, beginning of November. Okay. Yeah, so we'll have podcast after this episode coming out. I interview Naomi and Naomi Boswell and Erica Douglas Osborne, and then Dr. Jane Park and Dr. Hannah Fleming, and then I also interview my PhD student Anna Anna Kennett, who's at the University of Bristol, who contributed to one of the chapters as well.
Awesome. What was that? No, I think over the course of the conversation, we've covered a bit what that collaboration was like in producing the book. And obviously, it's a core value of the project anyway.
Yeah,
exactly. But, you know, what were the pros and cons of that approach? You're somebody who might be thinking of...
Sounds cheesy, but it's hard to think of any con. Pros, the more I collaborate with people, the more I want to. It would have been really ironic if I hadn't collaborated with people on this book. I've been really fortunate. The people who did collaborate with me have given me really lovely feedback, touch wood. They all seem, from what they've said, to have really enjoyed the process. And then also from a real personal perspective, I wrote the book proposal right before I gave birth. And then I had my child during lockdown, and it was a very lonely time for everyone. As one of the people going through that, it was for me. And actually, the book gave me a grounding, and the collaborations just were a very specific pro in that context. But I guess that does apply more generally to my work and my job. I do feel really grateful that every day I go into work and I get opportunities to interact with people and have, hopefully, you know, really positive social connections. And obviously, that doesn't motivate everyone, and it shouldn't, but it does motivate me. So that was a real pro of it as well. Oh, also, I should also mention, you know, Routledge and Beachmark were really great publishers and really easy to work with and positive, and seemed to really get the topic as well. So in conclusion, it was a really great experience. I'm so glad I got to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really glad that you've been able to provide this for our listeners, and I'm aware that
thank you for giving me the opportunity.
No problem at all. Thank you for doing it. But it's been a really, really interesting conversation, Ali, and just to kind of bear witness, I guess, from your journey from that sort of alienation of lockdown and just hearing how you've used academia, which sometimes can be pilloried as an ivory tower project kind of thing, which is self-sustaining, to spread out to education, to give people the practical tips and hints and practices to form a discipline which helps them to develop that value around, including different voices within educational practices. A phenomenal achievement, and thank you very much. For doing that.